Today we're going to talk about the book of Exodus, and I'm not going to go through every book of the Old Testament one by one because it would take us a long time to get through the Old Testament if we did that way, but there are some books that are more crucial and pivotal than others, and this is one of those very important books of the Old Testament. There are three main events in the Old Testament that are sort of the key events in the life of the Israelite people that shaped their identity. One was the call of Abraham, we talked about in the book of Genesis, and then you've got the book of Exodus, which has the departure from Egypt, because they were slaves in Egypt. When you read the Old Testament, throughout the rest of the law, but also into the Psalms and in some of the prophets, it talks about their experience as slaves in Egypt. And this is what made them who they became. And we know that this was not something that they would have made up, because no nation would say, hey, our heritage is we were slaves in this other country. They held us in bondage for 400 years, and then we were set free. That's not something you would make up. You'd much rather be the triumphal kingdom that had people in slavery than people who had been in slavery. And then the other event is the exile. So when you're reading the Old Testament, if you understand those things as being sort of the linchpins to the whole thing, because when you get into the historical books, you can see how things are leading up to the exile, and then the prophets are predicting the exile. And then after that, of course, you've got prophets that talk about the return of the people, and then you've got books that record the return, like Ezra and Nehemiah. So, and that's what really cured the Israelites of their temptation to keep falling away into idolatry, which they, prior to that time, had a bad habit of doing. So the book of Exodus in English, the title is taken from the Greek Exodus, although in Greek it would be OS at the end rather than US, that's sort of a Latinized ending. And that means to go out, which is a descriptive name for the book, because that's what it's talking about in the book. But in Hebrew, the name of the book is Shemot, which means names. And that's the full title of the book in Hebrew is These Are the Names, and These Are the Names, actually, because those are the first words of the book. And that tends to be the way Hebrew books got their names, is just with the beginning of the first few words in the book. And because it begins with recounting the patriarchs who went into Egypt. And the fact that it begins with "and" shows that it's not a standalone book, that it's a continuation of the narrative that you had going on in the book of Genesis. Like the book of Genesis, the book of Exodus is really divided into two halves that have a middle point transition. And also, like the book of Genesis, there's a covenant that's in the middle of that. In the book of Genesis, you have God's calling and covenant with Abraham. In the book of Exodus, it's got the covenant on Mount Sinai is sort of the center point of the book. So the first half of the book, which has the content that most of us are familiar with, because that's kind of all the fun stuff that happened in the movie with Charlton Heston's, it's chapter 1 through 18. So it begins with chapter 1, which gives us sort of a prologue, and then gives us the life of Moses, his battle with Pharaoh, and then the departure of the people. And then chapters 19 through 20 talk about God's covenant on Mount Sinai. 19 through 24, I should say, talk about God's covenant on Mount Sinai. And then chapters 25 through 40 talk about the tabernacle. And you might think, well, why do they spend so much time? Because that's quite a few chapters to talk about the tabernacle. But this is where the people of Israel encountered God, and it later is what became the temple. But this was the tent form of the temple before they had a permanent location to worship God. And that second half of the book is actually divided into three sections further. There's 25 through 31 that give you the instructions on how the tabernacle would be made. And then there's chapters 31 through 34, which is the golden calf incident, which was basically the breach of the covenant. You've got everything's going good up to that point, relatively speaking, and then the people of Israel fall into apostasy to such an extent that God's telling Moses, I'm ready to wipe these people out. It was only through the intercessions of Moses that he didn't do that. And then the last half of that third section is chapters 35 through 40, which is where God restores the covenant. Moses gets new tablets, and then that happens as part of that 31 through 34 section. And then the last part, 35 through 40, is where you have the building of the tabernacle. And also it talks about not just the actual tent itself, but also all the furnishings and the vestments for the clergy. So the first section we'll talk about in a little bit more detail, but chapter 1 sets up the story. So you've got Genesis ended with Joseph being the second ruler in Egypt, and his family go and they settle there. Chapter 1 says that they multiplied and they grew and became great in number. But then there arose a Pharaoh that knew not Joseph, it says. So there's a Pharaoh that didn't care anything about the fact that these people were connected with this man who had been an important person in the life of Egypt. And so he put the Israelites into slavery and then became concerned about the fact that they were continuing to multiply and that they were a threat to the stability of the country, and so was trying to limit their population by killing all their male children. And then chapter 2, you've got the birth of Moses, which he's born. Of course, he's a target of this plan of the Pharaoh to wipe out all the male children, but he spared miraculously. But it moves very quickly from that point. You know, in the movie The Ten Commandments, there's a whole lot of drama that takes place. But in the book of Exodus, by the end of chapter 2, you've already got Moses having slain an Egyptian and fled into the wilderness. So there's not a lot of detail that's actually given in the book of Exodus about Moses' life as a prince of Egypt. But the Jewish tradition does fill in some of the gaps. The Jewish tradition actually makes some sense of some stuff that's not really easy to understand. Because later on in the book of Numbers, there's mention of Moses having an Ethiopian wife that his brother and his sister are giving him a hard time about. And you're wondering, okay, where did this Ethiopian wife come into the picture? Because when he goes to Midian in chapter 2, he meets Zipporah, who's the daughter of Jethro, and he winds up marrying her. And so you think that's his wife. There's no other mention of any other wives. And out of the blue, there's this mention of this Ethiopian wife. Well, the Jewish tradition is that before he fled Egypt, he was a commander, you know, with the Egyptian army. They had a war with the Ethiopians, and they conquered the Ethiopians. And this princess of Ethiopia was very impressed by him on multiple levels. They wound up getting married. So in the movie The Ten Commandments, there's that opening scene where you've got all these Ethiopians that are bringing all the loot into the royal chamber, and you've got this princess that seems to have some eyes for Moses, but that's as far as the movie carries it. But according to tradition, he actually married this woman. But when he fled into Midian, he didn't take this one with him. So when he left, when he went back to Egypt and then departed with the Israelites, this wife departed with him. So then from beginning with chapter 3, going on to chapter 4 and ending about verse 16, you've got the call of Moses. Moses, you know, is off in Midian. He's shepherding the flocks of his father-in-law, and he sees this burning bush. And one thing that's interesting, because we've talked a little bit about how there are forms that you find throughout the Old Testament, which the only kind of verbal forms that we still have in our culture are jokes, like knock, knock, who's there? When you hear knock, knock, you know what's going to come, or there were three guys in a bar, you know, those kinds of jokes. We all know there's a certain pattern to those kinds of jokes. But there are a lot of verbal forms in the Bible that are not humorous. They're just, but they do indicate certain things. And in this encounter that Moses has with the burning bush, it says that, so when the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called out to him from the midst of the bush and said, "Moses, Moses." This is something you find throughout the Bible when God would address people. Particularly when he was calling them, he would call their name twice, and the proper response is, here I am. And the Apostle Paul is the one exception, when you have these kinds of patterns and there's a break to the pattern, that break tells you something. And so when the Apostle Paul, instead of saying, "Here I am," says, "Who are you, Lord?" that's a significant response, because it shows that he didn't have any idea who was it that was addressing him, whereas all these other people prior to him recognized God when they saw him. And then it says in verse 13 of chapter 3, "Then Moses said to God, 'Indeed, when I come to the children of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them?' And then it says, 'And God said to Moses, I am who I am.'" Now, one of the significances of this is in the Gospel of John, there's a lot of "I am" statements that begin with, in Greek, "ego eimi," "I am," emphatic "I am," not just "I am," but "I am." And that's how it's worded in the Greek Septuagint translation. It says, "ego eimi haon," "I am the one who is." And so when Christ is using that pattern, "I am the one who is," and before Abraham was, "I am," he's clearly identifying himself as God. There's not any ambiguity about it. And that's also why in icons of Christ, you have this ha'on in the halo. That's saying "I am" is what is, if you were going to translate that into English letters, that's what that would say. Okay.
This translation says, "I am the being," which is also kind of accurate.
Well, I think "I am the one who is a better translation. I mean, the word is the verb to be, and it's a participial form, if I remember my Greek grammar correctly there.
Yeah, because you can't make it perfect, but right. It's interesting.
Right. Right. That's one of the problems with a lot of translations that are more recent, is that there's this theory of translation where they try to convey the meaning rather than to be literal, and the problem is you wind up with these kinds of really interpretative translations, whereas I think it's better for us to try to stick as closely to the wording as possible so that we can more fully appreciate what's really being said. Although sometimes when you compare translations, you can at least get a better idea of what, you know, the possible range of meanings of these words are. But then the next section, Moses is convinced to go ahead and go to Egypt to speak to Pharaoh, even though he's reluctant. He says, "You know, I don't know how to speak, I'm hard of speaking." And he says, "You know, Aaron can speak for you." Basically, he gives God excuses and God gives him solutions. And so finally he goes. And so he goes back to Egypt in chapter 4, beginning with verse 17 through the end of that chapter. And then in chapters 5 through 11, you've got the battle with Pharaoh that leads to the nine plagues, followed by the final plague, the tenth plague, which is the crucial one, the one that Passover revolves around. And that begins with chapter 12 through 13. And so when it starts talking about how the Egyptians' firstborn would be slain, it then talks about how the Israelites had to sacrifice a lamb and put blood on their doorpost. And if I'm remembering correctly, I think some of the fathers say that the form of the blood that was put on the doorpost was in the form of crosses, but basically this was symbolic of the sacrifice of Christ that redeems us from our sins and spares us from the punishment that's our due. And so while the firstborn of the Egyptians were slain, the firstborn of the Israelites were spared. But in the middle of all that, you've got Moses being told how people will celebrate this going forward. And it kind of seems strange to us that in the middle of all this drama, you suddenly got this talk about the commemoration. But it was important for the Israelites to understand that there was a direct connection with the way that they were celebrating the memory of this great event and the actual event itself. So that's the reason why it's there. And then beginning with chapter 14, going into chapter 15, verse 19, you've got the crossing of the Red Sea and the Song of Moses. And well, one thing I should say about the whole thing with the Passover is, what's the Greek word for Passover? Pascha, right. So this has a direct connection with our celebration of Easter. Just like the Israelites were delivered from slavery on the first Passover, we're delivered from the slavery to sin by the Passover that foreshadowed in Christ. And then with the crossing of the Red Sea, that also foreshadows baptism, because the Israelites went through the sea. They went through the water, although they were walking as though it was on dry land, but the water was on either side, so they went underneath the level of the water. And so St. Paul talks about that as symbolic baptism that they all went through. And then, beginning with chapter 15, verse 20 through chapter 17, verse 16, you've got the journey to Mount Sinai, where this is where they first start receiving manna, because they didn't have any food to eat. They also get water from a rock, and they have their first battle with the Amalekites. And in that battle, there's the foreshadowing of the cross, because Moses has his arms outstretched, as it says in the katabasi of the cross, in the form of a cross. He's holding his staff, but according to tradition, he's holding his staff out like this. And so he's got a bar, and he's holding it out in the form of a cross, and his arms get tired. So when his arms would slack, the Israelites would start to lose the battle. So Aaron, his brother, and Hur, I believe, who was his brother-in-law, came on either side of him, and they held up his arms, and so the Israelites were able to win the battle. But this was a foreshadowing of the cross. And then and manna is a foreshadowing of the Eucharist, because you've got the bread from heaven that Christ talked about. And then in chapter 18, you have the 70 judges that are chosen, which there are 70 judges that are chosen by Moses, and then there are 70 what in the Gospels? 70 apostles. So you've got the 12 patriarchs, which we have 12 apostles, and then you've got the 70 apostles, which were sort of lesser apostles than the 12. And so Christ had these numbers of apostles because it was symbolic of the fact that he was establishing the new Israel, which was the church. And then that's the end of the first section, the one that we tend to know the best. And then the second section we kind of know too, because this gets into the whole Ten Commandments, which is pretty dramatically portrayed in the movie. So this section runs from chapter 19 through chapter 24. Chapter 19 is where the Israelites first encounter God on Mount Sinai, and they're prepared to be in the presence of God. And so they're told to fast for 3 days and to, you know, abstain from marital relations and to prepare themselves, to wash themselves, wear clean clothes. And so this is the origin of a pious practice that many people have of fasting for 3 days prior to receiving communion. Now, I would say that that's not a mandatory practice, and particularly if you receive communion on Sunday, you shouldn't really be fasting strictly on Saturday, because the canons actually forbid fasting strictly on Saturday. So the only kind of semi-exception is Holy Saturday. You had a question?
Yes, I have a question, because the National Church is supposed to fast Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
Right, this is a pious custom, and like in the Greek practice is at least not, they won't let, most of them won't eat meat for 3 days if they're going to receive communion. But it's not a mandatory practice to do that, but it is mandatory to fast from the midnight before you receive communion. And one of the problems with that practice is, like for a lot of the really pious Greeks, is they don't receive communion on Sunday, because they understand they're not supposed to fast strictly on Saturday. So what they'll do is they'll just receive communion on Saturday. And so that's when you have a custom that leads you to not do something that clearly is something the church has always encouraged people to do, which Sunday is the most important day of the week. So to not receive communion on Sunday is clearly not a good development. But all that to say, I mean, that's the origin of that pious custom, however you want to work that out, but it's not mandatory. So some people think that it is because they're told that. It's really not mandatory, certainly not in the Russian church. And then chapter 20 through 23 is the actual giving of the covenant by God, or the establishment of the covenant. So there are four covenants in the Old Testament that are talked about. There's the covenant that God made with Noah. There's the covenant God made with Abraham. There's the covenant that God made with Moses, which is what we're talking about now. And then there's God's covenant with David. And then in the prophecy of Jeremiah, there's talk about another covenant, which would one day come, the new covenant, which the Apostle Paul says in the book of Hebrews, if these other covenants were sufficient by themselves, there wouldn't have been a need for a new covenant. So the new covenant has connections with all of these things. It's really the fulfillment of all four of those original covenants. So it's not like it's totally out of the blue. It's really those covenants really foreshadow this ultimate covenant, which is really how all mankind is saved. Even those prior to Christ were saved by faith in Christ, even if they didn't really understand it fully, because they were believing in the things that were foreshadowing the Christ that was to come. Now, it became popular to dismiss a lot of the historicity of the books of Moses among especially liberal German scholars in the 19th century, but archaeological evidence has shown that the covenant that you find, particularly they especially like to dismiss the book of Deuteronomy as being something that was really fairly lately composed. But what they found was that there was a pattern to a certain kind of treaty that existed in this period of time that didn't, you know, it existed at that time, so people at that time understood the form, but later on that wasn't what people continued to do. It's called a vassal treaty or a suzerain treaty, but this kind of a treaty would be a treaty where you've got like a king who's really powerful, and then you've got some city that makes a deal with that king. So they agree to be in a covenant relationship, and basically they're going to do certain things for the king, and the king is going to do certain things for them, and they're making solemn promises to each other. And so the format of that treaty is what you find in the books of Moses. And so when scholars came to realize that, yeah, right around the time of the Exodus, which I forgot to mention, but there are two traditional or common dates that are given for the Exodus. One is in the 1400s BC, and then the other one's in the 1200s BC. And the reason why there's a discrepancy is because trying to piece together the hints that you've got in the scriptures, there's different pieces that some people would interpret it to mean that it's got to be the 14th century or 15th century BC. But the 1200s or the 13th century BC date fits a little bit more of the pieces. That's the time of Ramses II. And there's mention of the Israelites building certain cities, that's the main reason why they can come to conclude that that's the most likely date. But this treaty existed at that time. It didn't continue on long after that. So the idea that it could have just been made from whole cloth later on is something that it doesn't hold a lot of water. So anyway, the format of that treaty is, it begins with a preamble that identifies who's involved in the treaty and the author or the main party of the treaty and their title. And so in Exodus chapter 20, verse 1 through the first part of verse 2, it says, "And God spake all these words, saying, I am the Lord thy God." So there's the preamble. And then there's a prologue, which basically talks about the history of the parties up to that point. And so the second half of verse 2 says, "Which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage." So this is God's claim on why he's got a right to be in the driver's seat of this treaty is expressed there. And then you've got the stipulations of the treaty, which immediately following that, you've got the Ten Commandments. And the Ten Commandments really encapsulate all the other laws that come later on and are talked about. And there's also some other things that are talked about after the Ten Commandments. But basically, that's the main stipulations of this covenant between God and the people of Israel. And then you've got the provision for the depositing of the text of the treaty, along with an understanding or an agreement that this will be reread with some periodic frequency. So a lot of these like Hittite treaties is the main archaeological evidence that they have of this. But often it would say that every year on a certain date, this treaty would be read to remind people of what they had agreed to. Well, in the books of Moses, you have statements along those lines. In Exodus 25, verse 16, it says, "And thou shalt put into the ark of testimony which I shall give thee." So there's, it's saying this is where you're going to put the text of this covenant. And then Deuteronomy chapter 10, verses 1 through 5 says, "At that time the Lord God said unto me, Hew thee two stone tablets, like unto the first," because this is after he broke the first set of tablets that God made with his own hands, "and I will write on the tablets the words that were in the first tables, which thou breakest, and thou shalt put them in the ark. And I made an ark of shittim wood, and hewed two tables of stone like unto the first, and went up to the mount, having the two tables in mine hand. And he wrote on the tables, according to the first writings, the Ten Commandments, which the Lord spake unto you in the mount, out of the midst of the fire, in the day of the assembly. And the Lord gave them unto me, and I turned myself and came down from the mount and put the tables in the ark, which I had made, and there they be, as the Lord commanded me." And then in Deuteronomy chapter 31, verses 10 through 13, it says, "And Moses commanded them, saying, At the end of every 7 years, in the solemnity of the year of release," because every 7 years they had to release slaves, any property that was in hawk, they had to return and that sort of thing. In the year of the Feast of Tabernacles, when all Israel is come to appear before the Lord thy God in the place which he shall choose, thou shalt read this law before all Israel in their hearing. Gather the people together, men, women, and children, and thy stranger that is within thy gates, that they may hear, and that they may learn and fear the Lord your God, and observe to do all the words of this law, and that their children, which have not known anything, may hear and learn to fear the Lord your God, as long as ye live in this land, whither ye go over Jordan to possess it." And then after that, it talks about the blessings if you keep the treaty and the curses if you don't keep the treaty. And I'll just read some examples that you find in here. But this is from Deuteronomy chapter 28, beginning with verse 1. And it says, "And it shall come to pass, if thou shalt hearken diligently unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe and to do all his commandments, which I command thee this day, that the Lord thy God will set thee on high above all the nations of the earth, and all the blessings shall come on thee and overtake thee, if thou shalt hearken to the voice of the Lord thy God. Blessed shalt thou be in the city, and blessed shalt thou be in the field. Blessed shalt be the fruit of thy body, and the fruit of thy ground, and the fruit of thy cattle, the increase of thy kind," which is a King James word for cattle, "and the flock of thy sheep. Blessed shall be thy basket and thy store," etc., etc. The Lord shall establish thee in holy people unto himself, as he has sworn unto thee, if thou shalt keep the commandments of the Lord thy God and walk in his ways. "And the Lord shall make thee the head and not the tail, and thou shalt be above only, and thou shalt not be beneath, if thou hearken unto the commandments of the Lord thy God, which I command thee this day to observe and to do them. And thou shalt not go aside from any of the words which I command thee this day, to the right hand or to the left, to go after other gods to serve them." And then the same chapter 28 of Deuteronomy, beginning with verse 15, going all the way down to verse 68, so it's even a much longer section. It talks about all the curses that would fall on the Israelites if they didn't keep the covenant. It says, "But if thou shalt come to pass, if thou shalt not, will not hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God to observe to do all his commandments and his statutes which I command thee this day, that all these curses shall come upon thee and overtake thee. Cursed shalt thou be in the city, cursed shalt thou be in the field, cursed shall be thy basket and thy store, cursed shall be the fruit of thy body and the fruit of thy land, the increase of thy kind, the cattle, and the flocks of thy sheep. Cursed shalt thou be when thou comest in, cursed shalt thou be when thou goest out. The Lord shall send thee cursing, vexation, rebuke, and all that thou settest thine hand unto for to do, until thou be destroyed, and until thou perish quickly because of the wickedness of thy doings." And it goes on for quite a whole nother page. "Thou shalt betroth a wife, and another man shall lie with her. Thou shalt build a house, and thou shalt not dwell within, thou shalt plant a vineyard, and shalt not gather the grapes thereof. Thine ox shall be slain before thine eyes, and thou shalt not eat thereof. Thine ass shall be violently taken away from before thy face, and thou shalt be shall not be restored unto thee, etc., etc. Moreover, all these curses shall come upon thee, and shall pursue thee, and overtake thee, till thou be destroyed, because thou hearkenest not to the voice of the Lord thy God to keep his commandments and his statutes, which he commanded thee. And they shall be upon thee for a sign and a wonder, and upon thy seed forever, because thou servest not the Lord thy God with joyfulness, with gladness of heart, for the abundance of all things. And then skipping down quite a bit further, because like I said, this is a very long section. And among all of these nations shalt thou find no ease, neither shall the sole of thy foot have rest, but the Lord shall give thee there a trembling heart and failing eyes and sorrow of mind, and thy life shall hang in doubt before thee, and thou shalt fear day and night, and shalt have none assurance of thy life. In the morning thou shalt say, would God it were evening. And at evening thou shalt say, would God it were morning. For the fear of thine heart wherewith thou shalt fear, and for the sight of thine eyes which thou shalt see. And the Lord shall bring thee into Egypt again with ships, by the way whereof I spake unto thee. Thou shalt see it no more again. And there ye shall be sold unto your enemies for bondsmen and bondswomen, and no man shall buy you. So you're going to be sold into slavery, but no one's even going to want to buy you as a slave. That's how cursed the Israelites were going to be. Again, in Deuteronomy chapter 39, verses 19 through 20, where it's talked about the witnesses that will be there, the witness to this event. And I shall call earth to record this day against you, that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore choose life, that both thou and thy seed may live, that thou mayest love the Lord thy God, and that thou mayest obey his voice, and that thou mayest cleave unto him, for he is thy life and the length of thy days, that thou mayest dwell in the land which the Lord sware to thy fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, to give them. So basically, it's, you know, God's made it very clear they've got choices. Now, the next section of the vassal treaties format is there's ratification with sacrifices, which we read about in Exodus in that section. I believe it's chapter 24, talks about the actual sacrifices that were initially done, and then that's the end of the middle section. And then the third section is, as I said, talking about the tabernacle. In the first section, chapters 25 to 31, basically are just giving Moses very detailed instructions on how the tabernacle would be made, what kinds of material, and what vestments the priest would wear. There's some talk of some of the offerings that would be made. And then, beginning with chapter 31, there's the golden calf incident. And that story, when you read it in the actual Bible, there's some funny elements to it, because Aaron, Moses' brother, is talked into making this golden calf by the people of Israel while Moses is up on the mountain. And the people are thinking, well, he may never come down. We don't want to go up there to find out, because we're afraid, you know, to go up there, because, you know, we're afraid to be in God's presence. But let's make this golden calf so he can lead us out of here. And when Moses later on asks his brother, why did you do that? Aaron says, well, you know, these people, they gave me this gold and I put it in this melting pot, and out came this calf. You know, it just came out. Not taking any responsibility whatsoever. And then you have the renewal of the covenant. God appears to Moses. Moses intercedes on the people's behalf. He's given new tablets because he's broken the first tablets, and because he's so angry when he sees the people worshiping this golden calf. But the covenant is restored. And then you have the building, the actual making of the tabernacle in chapters 35 through 40. And then the very conclusion of the book is Exodus chapter 40, beginning with verse 34. It says, then a cloud covered the tent of the congregation, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter into the tent of the congregation because the cloud abode thereon, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And when the cloud was taken up from over the tabernacle, the children of Israel went onward in all their journeys. But if the cloud were not taken up, then they journeyed not till the day that it was taken up. So in other words, when that cloud of glory wouldn't move, they wouldn't move. But when it did move, then they would follow the cloud. For the cloud of the Lord was upon the tabernacle by day, and fire was on it by night, in the sight of all the house of Israel throughout all their journeys. So the book of Exodus ends with God once again being present to the people of Israel. If you go back to the book of Genesis, after the creation, Adam was in the garden on a daily basis. He would, it says, walk in the garden with God and commune with God. But you had the fall, so there's the separation between God and man. And then there's all these falls that happen in the book of Genesis, but then you have this covenant that God makes with Abraham, and so you they have the beginnings of this restoration of relationship. And so now we are at this point where they have a place where they can go and they can meet God, they can worship Him, and God instructs them on how they have to come to Him, because they can't just do whatever they want, they can't treat Him any kind of way. There are certain things that they have to do to be in a right relationship with God. And so that's really what the book of Leviticus gets into, about how the people can be in the presence of a holy God. And so we'll talk about that next time.